Coleman, who's the director of the Net Lab at the University of Coleman. He's a professor in sociology, but he spends a lot of time hanging out with geeks like me. Computer science department's connection there is through the HCI group. And he's going to be talking about the tripleware evolution, which is social networks and the internet and personal mobile devices. We've got 55 minutes, followed by 5 minutes for questions. I will get lots of questions.
But I'm also from the Bronx, so I've never held one of these in anger in my life. And I had a hard time figuring out what this audience was going to be like until I looked at the picture that you all took yesterday. And then I knew instantly, but I still overdressed basically to hide the pot belly. But, or tried to. And of course, coming from the Bronx, some of the few people here know what fakakta means, although my mother would have washed his mouth out with soap. What I'm talking about is both the ending of a series of major research projects I've been doing and the beginning of a book that I'm writing for MIT Press on basically the intersection of social networks, which I'll talk about in this section, the internet, which I guess I don't need to talk much about, and personal mobile access, which 90% of you are exercising right now, including the guy there with the world's largest laptop, and the world's worst back. You lived in the Bronx. Great. Okay, we are the Bronx diaspora here. I've been here since 1967 when I had a choice of three jobs, Toronto, Hawaii, or Vietnam. And some of you even have history majors. Okay, and so I'm not going to show any equations with or without frogs. I will throw a little piece of data up, but I have a big fat website with lots of papers. And I'm talking about the intersection of one, the turn in social life from groups, and of which I don't mean the kind of groups that Professor Weinstein was talking about before, to social networks, both in reality and even more so in the way we think about the world, and or many people think about the world. Second, the proliferation and differentiation of the internet, which is in some ways inherently personal. And third is the notion that you can carry and take it with you, either through your laptop, your BlackBerry, may I single out BlackBerry in this hallowed premises, or your cheap old little phone, which is all I got, and what that really means in our lives. And it's moving towards what I think is a new way of social organization called networked individualism. So the internet, I'm going to not be much on internet stuff because you all know it. Basically, what you get is, I'm just going to repeat the obvious, but maybe some implications will be new, is instant access to diverse, copious information. By now, you should have gone to my website, Googled me, Wikipedia'd me, and find out all the stuff you need to know. And if that horrible person has put that trashy stuff on my Wikipedia page, ignore it. Second, we have rapid, low-cost communication. I don't know if you're running an IRC channel in this room commenting on talks or not. There is some variation on that. I know when I lecture at Microsoft, all sorts of snickers develop at various inappropriate times. But you know, if you're sucking on the large Microsoft teeth, then you've got to take the good with the bad. And clearly, for those of us who are over 20 here, in other words, not the mathematicians, distance and time are much less of a constraint now than when we grew up in communication. And we've discovered, working with Diana Mock, who's just down the street at the University of Waterloo, we modeled communication by email, linking it to actual relationships. And we found that up until 3,000 kilometers, that email was as frequent with ties nearby, or within 3 kilometers or more, actually, than there is with relationships 1,2500 kilometers away. 3,000 is a drop because, much to the surprise of some of the computer scientists I talked to, we actually have bodies. And so much email has to do with physical getting together. And you go over 3,000 kilometers from Toronto, you're over some ocean or not, or another, unless you're going way down to Chile, which is not very common. And one thing that's clear is we are communicating more rapidly and more copiously than ever in the history of the known universe. And we also have more information at our fingertips. I made the San Francisco Chronicle last week. It's, as you may know, Google's 10th anniversary. And this guy interviewed me for a half hour. And so I got a quote that says, Wellman says, information is more available than ever. For this, I spent a half hour of my time. What was fascinating is the reporter never Googled me. So he didn't have a clue what to ask me. Anyway, how many people here are from Toronto or Waterloo type areas? I'm just curious. Okay. You probably have heard of East York. It's a part of Toronto that, just for those of you, is north of the Danforth and east of the Don River. And it's a working class area. Basically, it used to be all British, and now it's multicultural. And we went out and did a whole bunch of interviews and surveying people 3 years ago about how they communicate. And these are some photos we took of average people's places. Possibly for this audience, this is not a revelation. When I go out to my other wonderful sponsors at Intel, it is, because they assume everybody has high-speed wireless broadband and the world's biggest computers and stuff like that. Nah, they're usually sitting in a basement with pseudo-knotty pine wallboarding. And as you can see, each kid in this household has his or her own computer. They're also a little techno-backward. This is 2005. One of my students looked and says, my God, they still have videotapes. Obsolete mechanism. But yeah, yeah. That was after what were they called, those 8-inch platters that came around for a while? You know, I took these because they show great taste in furniture design, and sending it to Architectural Digest pretty soon. But this is both good and bad. You know, we know that about 75% of North Americans and Canadians, have the computer. We know that today having a computer is virtually synonymous with having an internet connection, which is the great majority now are high speed. And we are seeing a trend to resolving family fights and tensions by having one computer per person rather than a shared computer. So whatever the ugliness of the furniture or these wonderful dolls that you can see too, this is real stuff. And one of the most important parts of it is one I would dare say that almost everybody does, and I'm guessing that almost all of you take for granted. When you log on as yourself or yourself. And that's really different than when those of us who had hair 10, 15 years ago and don't now picked up a telephone because it was coming into the house or coming in to the office and may have been shared by a group. So communication and information seeking has become intensely personal. Similarly, of course, hardly anybody shares a mobile phone. I know my wife and I did it for a little while until we realized that we basically wanted to talk to each other, and it was hard. Okay, so we take a lot of this stuff for granted. We take high bandwidth for granted. When I was getting bored and couldn't figure out the equation except for the frogs before, I was downloading and checking my stuff. We can get onto it almost anywhere, anytime. I have students at Toronto's the most multicultural city in the world, so I have a student from Nepal. Oh, yeah, of course we got on. I have a student from refugee camps of the Karen minority that got kicked out of Bernard's along the Thai border? Oh, yeah, of course. So anywhere, anytime, I'm exaggerating, of course, but we just shipped a whole bunch of computer books. Tim O'Reilly donated them to me to send to rural Ghana, east coast of Ghana, near the Volta River. And they were really, this internet cafe, we send students over there to work with folks. And they were really cool. They said, please send us Word 03 and not 07. And those of you who use both can understand that the Ghanaians are right with, they don't have to read the reviews. We have convergence more and more with BlackBerry. Seriously, I'm not just looking for money. Any media accessing all separate media, and that basically email and IM have come to mimic each other. It's almost a matter of taste preference. We have portability, except for this guy, of course. It's pretty obvious that it's going to shrink even more. Globalized connectivity, we can get to almost anybody. And personalization is, we make this our own. And that's one of the two big civil wars happening in the world, which is between centralized control and individual control of your computing medium. All of you have probably fought the battle with, I go back to 1960 at Harvard with the one big mainframe that we used to pray to with our punch cards. Oh, I remember when I was thinking of getting engaged, I deliberately dropped my cards, and my fiance helped me pick them up. And, you know, that's when I proposed to her. Sealed computers and central download controls and stuff like that, it's always been a kind of warfare situation. And now we have the mobile revolution, which basically means wherever you are and wherever you go, and it's almost always on. I don't know about your classes. Those, I assume most people here teach, unless you're on a perimeter ripoff situation. The next time you teach, and the one thing you do, every single student of mine does as they get up, even before they put on their coats and their snow boots and their mufflers and all that stuff, is go like this and check for messages. It is almost without exception in the class. They're connected. You know, we've compromised, as maybe many of you have. You can keep it on. You can even read it because I can't stop you, but you can't have the ringer going during the class. I get very violent. And once again, it's personal, which means all of a sudden, and for the first time in human history, as far as I know, the connectivity is to you rather than to your household unit. And there are a lot of places to sign on. I just was surfing around the pictures one day. This is people cell phoning on the beach. And with that is a new perspective for understanding social behavior called the social network revolution, except I realized I did that a little bit too glibly. Kind of the whole field of social network analysis started in the 1960s as a self-confident field, as a history book of it. I know a few people doing history of science that can point you towards it. Of course, social networks per se have been around forever, since the triadic relationship between God, Adam, and Cain, in which Adam basically said, I don't connect to Cain, and goes it the other way around. It's been a long time since my bar mitzvah. Am I my brother's keeper? And it's a way of looking at the world. I've done studies in the 18th century, working with some historians, that has developed methods for looking at societies that basically don't assume groupiness. But since the development of computer networks, since the development of the ease of the internet in helping long-distance relationships develop, people are much, much more aware of functioning in networks. And now Mark Zuckerberg has ripped off all the stuff that my colleagues have been doing and made $1 billion out of Facebook. Yeah. And Murdoch, bless his soul. So MySpace and MyFace are doing really, really well. Of course, Google itself is built on network analytic algorithms, as even before that FedEx was. So the difference is, and I guess I'm kind of a couple of slides saying that, in the old days, people used to think that the world functioned in all-encompassing, densely knit, bounded groups. And now we're more and more realizing that the way it's always functioned, but probably functions a bit more, we have very bad data over time, in quite fragmented networks in which the people you're relating to today, I almost guarantee you, not the people you get to relate to next week. These are sparsely knit, so a lot of people in your network don't know each other. They're permeable in a sense that the boundaries are really bad. I mean, I was really amazed here when I went walking through the whole building and no security guard stopped me, although I did find one locked door. And then I looked in at some of the blackboards. I realized I didn't understand anything anyway, so I couldn't really steal stuff. And these networks are specialized. We have hard empirical data that the people you get a lot of emotional support from are different than people you get money from. They're called parents, by the way. That's true. And they're different from the people you hang out with and have beers with. In our data, by the way, the most overloaded people in the world are adult sisters of adult brothers. Lots of crying on shoulders by brothers to sisters. My wife doesn't understand this stuff. I sort of said this already. Now, one consequence is there's probably more a premium on individual agency rather than letting the group do it. And this is an assertion rather than hard data. In fact, I'm going out and I and some students are going to read the interviews very carefully this year and look about it. If you read anybody read Bob Putnam's Bowling Alone book? Yeah, a couple of you. Well, he makes a big deal about machas, and I'll throw in some Yiddish too, which are people who make things happen. And we don't know whether people are actually making things happen or letting the world come to them. Now, in the old days, when you had one big happily connected family and everybody got to dinner on mommy's house on Sunday night, it's clear that the group did a lot of arranging for you. But now that we're into personal stuff, we're into husbands and wives having very much their own agendas, we're not quite sure how much individual agency on making it happen is going on. We also know that search has changed, and I know there's some librarians, that was Bronx, in the house. In the old days, we used to know it was a two-step flow of information. You read about it somewhere, and then you talk with your friends. But now we know there's, we know because I've done the research and with Jennifer Kayahara, there's an infinite flow of information where you may read about something on the web, you then go check it out personally, you then go back to the web, check something out. And it often goes through three or four or five cycles about that, including, you know, what's at the movies tonight kind of situation. So the old way of looking at stuff, still done in American political polls, you know, working women like Sarah Palin, because they all want their teen daughters to be knocked up, I guess, or that was a joke. I guess this is, by the way, 88% of Canadians voted for Kerry last time, except the votes weren't counted. But a friend of mine did that survey, so, you know. We should have world elections. The standard way is to take attributes, women, working class, stuff like that, and cross-classify them by various properties. It's individuals as owning attributes of themselves, and it basically sees the norms and attitudes that they were injected with as a sign of behavior, and it's a lot looking at densely knit groups. The network approach basically says these ties may or may not form in networks. They're usually pretty asymmetric, so the help Sabine gave me, I haven't done anything back for her except thank you. They're indirect connections, as we all know, through epidemiology. And so we can't just talk about one-on-one reciprocity. We got to talk about what's going on. If I yell at one of my graduate students, eight others gang up against me and say, you can't do that. It's an emergent network property. These tend to cluster empirically as well as theoretically. And so they're not necessarily densely knit. And therefore, we got to look at who's connecting people And these have differential definitions of resources. This is from an old theory paper I wrote some years ago. Okay. So, as I'm saying, I'm going to give you 12 points about the triple revolution with a little bit of numbers thrown in and a lot more when MIT Press comes out with the book in about a year. Now, we just convinced them to do it as a trade book, which means it'll be one-third the price of any other kind of book, which is and better advertising. One is, as I said, there's a lot more individual functioning, but despite what Bob Putnam had to say, we now know that people are not as disconnected. They're quite networked, but they're not networked as group members. They tend to go out to many events as individuals. We have some evidence on this. And as I said before, what's called in sociology the agency problem, the question then becomes how much do people operate their networks, or do their networks operate them, as used to be the case in groups. Remember traditional small groups way back in the dark ages were door-to-door in pre-industrial times. Remember Hillary Clinton? By the way, one of the most foolish things I've been reading is, too bad they didn't nominate Hillary because then she would have kicked Sarah Palin's butt. But remember sequence. If Hillary had been nominated, I think Sarah Palin would still be skinning moose in Alaska today. They would have gotten some white guy. Anyway, we Canadians love to talk about the U.S. because we know who creates our world. Okay. In a traditional village, all observe and interact with all deal with only one group, and knowledge comes basically from within the group and maybe a few ties coming out. And it's basically this kind of model to oversimplify. What happened when cars and planes and phones came along is what Keith Hampton and I call globalization, with a C up there in capital letters. And that meant, oh, when I was a kid in the 50s and 60s, we would drive off to somewhere, but we would get on the freeway, and we wouldn't know about anything until we got off. When Jerry and I, and I'm sorry, I don't know your name, when Saul would come from the Bronx down to Manhattan, the train would never stop at Harlem. The D train would refuse to stop there, so we wouldn't have evil beasties attack us. But we would only know about one end and the other end. So there was place-to-place connectivity, but very much as household units. And as I've been arguing now, it tends to be more an individual connectivity going on. I'm just going to skip this. And that means there's little awareness of context. When you call somebody on a cell phone, you don't know where the hell they are usually. And often, except for mathematicians, I guess the first question is, where are you and what are you doing? And we tend to tailor our media. We tend to have very personalized media. Even those of us who have landline phones tend to tailor how we're looking at them. 14% of Americans, adults now, have only this stuff without a landline phone. It's killing the self. It's killing the polling industry right now. They spend three times as much per cell phone in interview, they tell me. And those of us who live in cities with public transportation in particular know that people talk very loudly on these phones when they're in the streetcar. And thank God it hasn't made it to the Toronto subway yet. It's not that they're antisocial, but their sociability is focused on their communication through the phone. And despite any newspaper guys here, I've seen magazine people, despite newspaper reports, it is extremely rare to find people with many online-only relationships. Almost always, the online stuff is a combination with people already known in flesh worlds, in face-to-face kinds of meetings. And what it's used for is to maintain and arrange next encounters and keep it going in between. Now, did anybody meet an old friend from online that they had never seen in person here before? I'm kind of curious. Yep, who'd you meet? You want to talk to him. And you're sitting next to each other. Is it good for both of you? Yeah. Yeah. So, and that's just that's, wow, that's pretty impressive. And Sabine, you know, communicate. Yes, sir. Let me go back. Well, actually, I was talking about emails, and these are connections among individuals. What's the problem? Yeah, but they are related. But this makes no distinction between email and face-to-face contact. This could be either. Oh. Not necessarily. Right now you can't, but next time you go to New York, I'm flying to Seattle on Thursday night to see my really close cousins. And that's a meat spacer, if you want to use flesh. I'm not trying to be really sexy about it. And then we're going to be in touch. We've arranged this trip by email. One of them's getting married. But I see where you're getting at, and that's not a bad point. Yeah. Because when we communicate with each other, we tend to do it qua individual. We were still traveling before and still communicating, but it was household-to-household communication. Now we're using individual media to do it. Well, okay, I should be clearer when I talk. Okay, second, family stuff. We're coming out with a Pew report. Oh, I think it's middle of October, pewinternet.org. It's already done, but they have their own schedules. And Tracy Ken and I did a preliminary paper last year. We find that people spend a lot less in-person time than they did in the 1970s, but paradoxically, they're more in contact. I've called my wife 3 times today. Yes, I did make it to Waterloo. No, these are not monsters. What does Fakakta mean? You know, those kind of conversations. No, she went to Hebrew. She listened better at Hebrew school than I did. And in some funny ways, people are more aware of what each other are doing now because of this stuff. And some really obsessive people have Twitter. Any Twitters here? Don't confess. On friend feed, and they're telling me to wash my mouth out with soap. Yeah, okay. I will keep it clean. I just thought that's the way mathematicians talk. And this even stretches onto some assembly lines where basically there had been no contact during the day. We do find people are spending a fair amount of time in the evening. Those who are really old remember Ozzie and Harriet and Ricky and David from the 50s, 60s. And then there's Fun with Dick and Jane, which before it was a bad movie with George Segal, was the reader I learned with in PS33 in the Bronx. And it assumed, this is a page from about that era, it assumed a family unit and the women, I mean, there's all sorts of weird stuff here, women wearing dresses, and they stay home, whereas daddy goes out to work. Now I just picked these up at about 15 minutes browsing, and some of them will never make it to the book because it'll cost too much money. There's connectivity in a variety of ways. Basically, children start asking for and getting cell phones when they're 7 or 8 now, as far as we can see. It depends on the family, of course. And then I have a lot of quotes, which I think I'm running late on, so I'm not going to spend much time. But it's all about interpenetration of household and not. My student Julia texts her husband 50 times a day, every day. They're only married a year, and it would be kind of interesting to trace that as life goes on. But, you know, it's great. As long as it doesn't do it to work for me. Okay, yeah, the third thing we're finding is networked individuals that you can read tap into sizable loose networks. They have a variety of relationships. They're not specialized. You may have read a story. Anybody from New York here? Did a long interview with New York Magazine yesterday, and this will come out in about 4 months, where they're picking up on the loneliness articles that came out about 2 years ago that said Americans only have an average of 2.1 people they can discuss important matters with. The real reason that's going on is, one, lack of marriage is happening, and when you lose a marriage, you lose in-laws, basically. And secondly is relationships are pretty specialized now, as I mentioned earlier. And so there are people you hang out with, go to the pub with, but maybe don't discuss important matters with. This may have some good stuff. You could be able to maneuver, and may have some bad stuff. We also are starting to pick up on data, work that I haven't published yet, but Helen Wang and I gave a paper at the International Communication Association. We just got push the magic button that turns PowerPoint into English and send it off. That would be great. And we've traced friendship networks using the Center for Digital Futures World Internet Project data, and we've watched networks grow from 2002 to 2007. That's the last evidence that we have. And Jeff Bose and I did a study with the Pew people, and it's pretty clear that there's a correlation between intensive use of the internet to communicate and larger social networks. Where the causality is in that is an interesting kind of question that I can't answer. But people with large networks, and also people with a lot of networks abroad for obvious reasons, really use the internet. There used to be something called a digital divide. It's basically disappearing in North America. And one of the things was language. But now with the miracle of Skype and other internet phone kinds of things, we found that every single recent immigrant in our sample was talking home at a very high rate, and many of them using their kids to use email and texting, and a lot of people reading newspapers and listening to radio stations back from their homeland. So the whole notion that if you don't speak English, you don't do the internet seems to be kind of falling apart. Here's some large network size that Helen and I have done. And let's see, God, I should have memorized this. But okay, one thing you can see is people who are on the internet tend to have larger networks than the blue bars people who don't. And the numbers up here are the growth in network size from 2002 to 2007. Even the non-users are growing in networks. Now, the trouble is this is a phone survey, and the why question is one that escapes me. But we'll be looking at some other interview data and trying to figure it out. And I've said part of this before, but just put it in context, people rely on partial membership. There's a lot of turnover in relations, has to do with obvious stuff, moving, marriage, and divorce, and there's more divorce now. We don't know quite what MyFace is doing. Everybody has friends, and then they have to use an old word, friendsters, people who are on their MySpace page, and they're not hardly any close to. I get an invite a day, usually from somebody I never heard of. And we need to know what that's doing. The New York Times Sunday Magazine, not a definitive source, gave some hints that there's some reaction to overload. I won't go on Facebook because I do want to guard my privacy a bit. And people spend a lot of time figuring out where they're going to get what help from. So there is a palpable shift from to shared interests, where some of the people here study communities of scholars. That's an obvious kind of thing to do. On the other hand, proximity is still important. Most people go into work. Most people, it's not just Mad Men in the 1950s. And most people talk to people at work more than they talk to anybody else except possibly their household. So proximity still pays off. Cups of sugar are not virtually transferable. Amazon can't get it to you in time. So there is some distance bias still going on, but there's a great deal of notions of people actually sharing interests and dealing with it. The extreme case is this guy. He actually doesn't do this anymore, Ryan Lackey. Who lived on a former oil drilling rig in the English Channel. It was actually set up as a data haven for gambling and other nefarious pursuits on the grounds that nobody would invade it until the British Navy came. They found, you know, since the Falkland War, they've been shopping a little bit. And so anyway, he had only virtual friendships. He was an extreme case. He met the supply ship once a month. We've done some studies on local relationships. There had been some fears that people were going to spend so much time online that they were never going to relate to their neighborhoods. And Keith Hampton, who used to be at MIT, is now at Annenberg School in Pennsylvania, and I did a Netfil study where we found that wasn't true, that basically the internet augmented face-to-face relationships. And local was there, but it became just another interest. Now, it turns out, as Keith has continued with the work in his iNeighbors study, that you really need listservs to kind of build local neighboring. When you get active listservs, it really, really helps. And you can do variations on listservs. You can have chats or what's it, friend.com, et cetera, et cetera. As I mentioned earlier, the amount of virtual friends is really small. And this doesn't compare with the other channel, but this is anybody you really know online. It's not your really close friends. It's gone up a bit from 4.1 to 6.4 for heavy users, and doubled, more than doubled in 5 years, but it's still a small fraction of the 250 people to 300 that the average North American knows enough to have a hello, how are you discussion with. Hopefully you've increased your network, but I hate to say it, a lot of conference ties don't last unless you start stroking them by email or other means afterwards. We also find some evidence of migratory ties, which these gentlemen here are part of, in which you meet online and then it moves to an in-person kind of relationship, at least in part, and that's been going up too. And part of the paradox of neighboring actually being maintained by the internet is Jane Jacobs, who started in New York but lived in Toronto. She's actually my neighbor from 1969 till her death about, I think, 2 years ago now. Is when you're sitting at a computer, very often you're sitting at home and you have a window outside, you actually keep your eyes on the street and you become very locally aware, and it's actually pretty important to you then if you go off to work. We're finding a fair amount of people working at home now, not just knowledge workers, as I assume most of us think we are, but also people doing call center stuff. If Canadians know the company Pizza Pizza, they do all their calls with home workers. It's a lot cheaper. But we find that now that there are three different categories. Work schleppers are people who bring their work home from the evening and do a little bit, or sometimes we call them overtimers. And school teachers are a good example of that. We have part-timers that seem somewhat different, and full-timers are working a lot at home. And I don't have really good data on this yet, but I will in about a month as we write it up. This is one that just shows that neighboring, actually, the more you worry, the more you're connected. I'm running out of time, so I won't spend much on that. We do find, and this, the data is really weak, this major studies need to be done. There's some suggestion would be really better than we do find. That at least in the knowledge working world, where we're pushing bits around rather than atoms, that people are part of several teams. They report to several bosses. Intel did a study internally up in the Portland area, and they found that people had five different reports going on. Nonetheless, their chips do get built. Richard Florida, who's now my colleague at Toronto, maintains a lot of have some skepticism about his data, that there's been a shift towards technologically connected jobs. Clearly, people are working over long distances using a battery of media. The few little studies I've done shows, yes, they do work over many media, but generally there's a strong bias to being local, that even being on a separate floor makes a difference to how much you communicate with somebody else. And the impersonal stuff seems to work okay over distance. So as many of us have suffered through call centers in India or the Philippines now, those aren't sustained peer relationships. There's also a great deal of surveillance. I'm not going to go through this stuff. But it takes too much time. Okay. Obviously, ICTs are doing a great deal. We're getting a lot of diversity, although one paradox we were talking about an hour ago is someone did a study, I forget the citation, that found that papers now are actually using fewer sites than they did before Google Scholar and Web of Science and Hartzing's publisher, Paris Schell and Google Scholar, actually made it easier to get stuff. Clearly, there's less dependence on experts. I literally ask my students where the library is, and they write a website down. They don't know where the building is on campus, even though it's one of the largest at the University of Toronto. We do. And I collapsed offices last year, and I wanted to donate books. It's at Harvard and St. George, Greg, if you were not funny. And I had 55 boxes of books, and I spoke to Carol Moore, the chief librarian. She said, "We don't take books anymore," it was a quote, or journals. And I shipped them to Vietnam, which is kind of full circle because I moved to Toronto in 1967 and 2007. 55 books are now at the Ho Chi Minh University of Social Sciences. May LBJ and Dick Cheney forgive me. It was kind of fascinating. They like books. But probably not very long. Okay, people get empowered, all these stuff that I sort of talked about before. And cultures of identity, we're just starting to get in to look at. This is more a hunch than a hard finding. People may or may not be switching among selves online. We do know, this is from Pew data, 84% of people belong to some sort of online community, may it be. People who are knitters or politicians or lancemen going back to the old country. And, you know, everybody finds interests online. This is, you can see it's rather old because the of the monitor is you know, almost obsolescent now. And this is really Lee Rainey stuff, so I'm not going to spend much time on it. The new media is making new groups splitting off. We don't have any really hard data on it. But there was a fear that people would only talk to people they know and therefore get reinforced in only their current beliefs. But Lee's finding a good deal of spillage, that people are still getting cross-fertilized information. So whether or not they like Sarah Palin or not, they're finding out about her. Same thing with Barack Obama, et cetera. So when ICTs come together with networks, we have both creation and transmission. We have, in some ways, more people creating than ever before, even if they're just Facebook pages. Of course, many people who put up Facebook pages have no notion that the world can look at them. I know at IBM, 10 minutes, thanks. I know at IBM that there is a, they make a speech to all new interns when they hire them that says, look, we're not going to censor you. You can put up any Facebook page you want, but we're going to go look at all of yours tomorrow. And they just get taken down real quickly. We've gone from mass media to what William Gibson has been calling ubiquitous media. And there's a lot of evidence. I'll have a trend slide in about 3 months on all the old media losing audience and new stuff picking up on it. And people have published stuff. Now, I have Google Alert that tells me when anybody mentions my name online, although it can't go into friendfeed.com, unfortunately or fortunately. And so I'll get blogs which talk about my work, and then I'll comment on the blogs, and typically the student authors are shocked. Blogs in my class are private. I think the classes should be a separate space. And people are spending a lot more time doing this. Okay, finally, as Friend Feed kind of brings out, we have the interpenetration of private and public. People, as I just mentioned, are revealing their inner thoughts and daily lives to a wider audience. A lot of private musings. I mean, how many YouTubes can you watch about a 3-year-old kid dancing on her mattress or something like that? Every once in a while, one of those takes off. Social availability software tells those who use it where you are. So one of my students broke up with her boyfriend, and she immediately changed relationship status to single on Facebook, and 200 people knew about that within the day, for better or worse. I'm not sure that was a great use of Facebook. Naomi Barron's written a book, she's a linguist at American U in Washington, called Always On, which talks about how people have been using away messages very, very much for this sorts of situations. They're surprisingly little concerned about privacy, and surprisingly little concerned about RFID chips and contactless credit cards, which are coming on now. Maybe there'll be some expectations about transparency and availability of people in institutions. I know in California there's a lot of, well, there's a good website that publishes who took donations from which institution for all legislatures. But there's a whole rethinking of public and private. Okay. Well, this is the list of 12 things, but I want to finish off now. So what we're having is an individualized but networked world where people need to be more proactive than ever before. We're finding that dyads are really, really the powerful thing. We just did a reciprocity study, and mostly it was the character of the one-on-one tie, and that the social networks are very badly bounded. Now, you folks can tell me more than I can tell you, but I think this is either a slow reflection or of a paradigm shift that I think is happening in scientific thinking and in world organization, and that is from the group-centered nature of the world to these fuzzier kind of networks. I threw these up as a kind of blue sky kind of thinking about how many things. I spoke to one person here, and I said, where have you worked? And he named 8 corporations. Well, he's a computer scientist. He has a career in a profession rather than a job in a company. Whether we've gone from Cold War blocks to fluid transitory alliances, I'm not sure of yet. Okay, so that basically is the end of my talk. This is the book that may or may not have this title and certainly won't be out for another year plus that Lee Rainey and I are doing on that. There's my website if you want to follow it up. My end, lots of articles at the Pew End, just pewinternet.org. And I'm happy to take questions for 4 minutes or so. Almost 10, yeah. Okay, no questions. Let's get coffee. Sir.
You talked about the fact that there's a very close relationship between online ties and people knowing one another in real life, so to speak. Do you know, I mean, which way the causality goes there? Like, it's presumably that you did say at some point in your talk that there's more and more of a shift now towards people meeting online around these interest groups and getting to know another in real life.
No, but it's mostly the other way. It's mostly people you've met face-to-face, going back to his point, that you then extend the conversations with them. And they could be local, as we just saying, of going to a movie about 1950 rock and roll. I was just on email that with some local people back in Toronto. It could be so many ties are not really local, but are 50 to 100 miles away. It could be maintaining those relationships, as I do with my friend at the University of Waterloo. I see it here. It could be immigrant relationships, but the causality, if I dare, but the sequencing is great majority of times from offline to online. Now, there are people in fellow interest groups, be it scholarly or just be it knitters, or be it Muslim women, or if I have an Iranian woman in Canada, that's okay. She's a full Shador woman. And it turns out Muslim women academics are graduate students in North America, feel very isolated and very hassled. And they have formed at least one internet support group that I know about, because Susan was part of it. And
very often when they go up to a conferences, they go find each other. If it's in another woman's home university, they'll go to that, even if that other woman's not at a conference, or else they'll meet at conferences. So, you know, there is bi-directionality, but the great majority of people are doing face-to-face stuff and not. And then there's, I see a few hands, but let me just finish on it. Then there are a few people who don't want to meet in person. I mean, I edit Wikipedia under a pseudonym. And, you know, every once in a while I get invited to meetups. And I don't want to come out. I really want to edit on a pseudonym so I can say bad things about Stephen Harper and not have too many consequences. And stuff like that. So, you know, there is some of that. I see a hand back there, and then Jerry. Nobody back there? Then Jerry would be next. And then you're... Jerry?
There are other online social networks that have emerged in the past few years outside of the more general ones as Facebook and MySpace. That there are literally dozens of them.
Hundreds.
Yeah. For example, LinkedIn as an example. Your observation seems to, in my opinion, based upon very superficial knowledge or observation, seem to apply more to the general social networks than the professional or specialized networks.
Yeah, I guess so, because most people are general people and not specialized professional people. I think it's pretty common, as with you and I, we knew about each other online, and you found me before I found you, but we met up here. I mean, those things happen. And one study I did, developmental psychologist, but I don't think the field matters, is we were trying to relate citation networks to social networks. And we expected what we didn't find. We expected that friends would cite other friends. To my surprise, we couldn't find that. We did a lot of tracing over time. This was with Howard White and Drexel, if anybody knows about his stuff. What we found is people who cited each other became friends, usually from meeting up at conferences like this. So, yeah, that sort of stuff happens. I think she was next to me.
Question. Your studies, I mean, it sounds very, very broad. Except what I didn't see is whether you have anything that's on the level of developing trust relationships.
Online?
Yeah.
I haven't done.
Okay.
I'm not sure who has, but possibly some people have. There's some early stuff by Sarah Kiesler at Carnegie Mellon that looked at that, but that's 15 years old,
right.
So I'm not sure if it holds up now. Okay, you one more? Yeah, you're it, I guess.
I was just going to ask about social perception within the scientific communities. I know it likely happens within, you know, the general community.
What do you mean by social deception?
Well, just people portraying themselves differently or pumping themselves up within a community online because they're online.
Yeah, I think people have different personas online. There's a guy on Wikipedia who was claiming to have invented everything to do with social networking software. Oh, it's taking us years to cool him down. I don't want to say his name in public, but I'll tell you privately if you want to really go through that. But I think it's kind of hard. People know each other. They read each other's work. There are different personas. Jerry looks different than I expected him to look. You know, he posts a lot for the Association of Internet Researchers that we're both on. I tend to write formally and talk informally, not always with Jewish curse words, but, you know, so people sometimes get fooled by, you know, they're surprised when they meet me, kind of thing. Is that where you go? But actually, frauds online?
I was just wondering if it has
no, and even the whole cyber stalking, males impersonating females, and that sort of stuff is, I mean, it's real, but it's really small as a percentage situation. It's a lot of media hype because that stuff, you know, not only sells, it just, you know, it's imageable and things like that. Whereas you say people are basically doing okay online, it's not a real story. Although I spent an hour with the New York Magazine reporter, she came to me with a story about loneliness. The new loneliness, and I think I converted it to the end of the new connectedness, you know, basically this stuff. I think. We'll see what it comes out in a few months. I'd like to. Is that it?
We have time for one more. No, we found two, so in the back.
Apropos of that, I just wanted to ask you what feedback you've been getting in terms of satisfaction and people's feelings about this new connectedness and how they feel themselves, what the sort of anecdotal or other evidence that you're finding about the notion. I mean, I tend to take it as a kind of normative good, the ability to embed ourselves in a variety of diverse communities. It's a higher social good. So is that what you're finding?
That's a great question. The definitive answer is we don't know. We actually set that. I spent yesterday making up a research agenda for my students this year, and that was one of the questions that we actually did. I haven't seen any systematic or even elusive evidence on that. We do know because Linton Freeman, who was one of the founders of Social Network Analysis, did some studies in UC Irvine years ago, and which seemed to suggest, I wouldn't claim it was definitive, that people like to feel they're parts of real groups and that they tend to give group names to things. I was a member of Fordham Flames when I was a kid, you know, we were a little gang in the Bronx, Fordham and the Concourse. And my hunch is there's a lot of uncertainty in the world and that even though people have a lot more ties, they don't belong to a group or that group. Maybe that's one of the reasons why people are finding, I believe, a lot of happiness online, although when, you know, when we find cyberbullying online, they could be unhappy. But we really don't know the satisfaction answer. Thank you for raising that issue.
Okay, I'd like to thank the speaker. I believe we've got a Michael.